We're 10 months into Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There's continuing fighting in the east and south of the country, and Russian President Vladimir Putin has said he's open to peace talks, but Ukraine and its Western allies have dismissed Russia's terms of negotiation.
Last week in Washington, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky thanked the U.S. for weapons and military help, and he asked for more.
We have artillery. Yes. Thank you. We have it. Is it enough? Honestly, not really. To ensure Bakhmut is not just a stronghold that holds back the Russian army, but for the Russian army to completely pull out, more cannons and shells are needed.
We have covered this war closely since it began, but let's get the latest and reflect a little on this past year for Ukraine and its people. Isabel Kershudian is on the line from Kyiv. She is Ukraine bureau chief for the Washington Post, our editorial partners. Isabel, welcome back and happy holidays.
Yeah, thank you, and happy holidays to you as well.
So this winter, U.S. intelligence officials expected a slowdown in what they called the tempo of this war, but we are seeing places like Kherson shelled continuously on this day, including a maternity ward hit. Is there a sense things are slowing down or not really?
Well, if you look at battlefield gains and losses, I do think that is slowing down. Unlike these big counteroffensives in Kharkiv and Kherson, where the Ukrainians got back a lot of territory very quickly, I don't think something like that is going to happen for a while. I think it'll be more kind of minimal gains probably until late February. But that doesn't mean the war is paused by any means. I think the fighting is ongoing. It's just neither side's really able to get an edge.
Last week, of course, President Zelensky came to Washington, D.C., and he spoke of the important role of American financial help and military help for Ukraine.
Your money is not charity. It's an investment in the global security and democracy that we handle in the most responsible way.
Isabel, it's clear he came to D.C. not just to give a speech, he's a great speaker, but to request more and additional weapons for this stage of the war. How critical is this next phase of military help from NATO, from the U.S.?
Yeah, and that comment specifically that you just aired, that's really kind of trying to get at, I would say, Republican congressmen and women specifically who maybe have, you know, some questions about where is all this money going to, the security assistance, how is Ukraine handling it? And I do think part of why Zelensky came was to kind of shore up this bipartisan support before the end of the year. It is important to Ukraine. It's really critical. They're at kind of a point in the war where it's going to be hard to get more territory back, where winter is going to be slow, where they need this next phase of weaponry to, again, tilt the battlefield in their favor, because Russia has more people coming. They've mobilized fighters. And, you know, it's possible that Russia, after some months, will be able to kind of regroup and make another push again. I think that's what Ukraine is worried about, another fresh offensive from the Russian side.
And let me ask you about the Russian side. Your byline was on a piece about the fate of a famous Russian brigade that has really struggled in this war. What does that story tell us about Russian challenges on the strategy side, on Moscow kind of understanding the limitations of its troops on the front line?
Yeah, that story was about the 200th Motorized Rifle Brigade. You know, that's a brigade that was considered elite before this war started, and kind of especially the Nordic countries had their eye on it and kept an eye on it and, you know, maybe estimated its ability in one way. And then it comes to Ukraine, fights predominantly in the Kharkiv region, and has suffered colossal losses. It's really been devastated. And it kind of speaks to not only how, you know, the world overestimated the Russian ability, but also that the Russians, what kind of losses they have taken, how they were not prepared, how certain, you know, forces seem really under-equipped, and why is that happening? And kind of this surprisingly, at times, ragtag state of even elite units in the Russian army. So, you know, I think those problems still persist, where you see a lot on social media from newly mobilized fighters saying, look at this helmet that I got, or, you know, look how thin this bulletproof vest is. That's really maybe what has surprised everybody, including, I would say, Ukrainians, is that the Russian army was built up to be one thing. It wasn't that when it got here. And now they've suffered so much losses that what is the state of it going forward?
Let me turn to Isabel and ask you some questions just about the Ukrainian people you have been able to speak to in your time there. Traditionally, Ukraine follows the Orthodox Church calendar and celebrates Christmas in January. This year, the Orthodox Church let its member churches, I understand, celebrate on December 25th. And there was a poll that a majority of Ukrainians might want to actually celebrate it on December 25th. What does that tell us?
I think it shows kind of this movement that has been maybe growing for years now, but has certainly been accelerated since, you know, Russia's full-scale invasion on February 24th, to become more like the West. I mean, Ukraine very much wants to be a part of Europe. It sees itself as a part of Europe and wants to be in the EU and NATO, and now has completely made this Western turn. And more even on top of that, it wants to reject anything that's remotely like Russia. And so if Russians celebrate their Christmas on January 6th and 7th, then Ukrainians want to do it, you know, December 24th as Christmas Eve and December 25th as Christmas.
Isabel, let me ask you about your own family. You have family in Odessa, in the southern part of Ukraine. In the middle of this war, how have your family members been able to celebrate this holiday season, to kind of get by with energy, electricity, and short supply that we've read so much about?
Yeah, well, like really any Ukrainians, they're creative and, I guess, resourceful, but also just incredibly resilient. That's the word I'm looking for, I think. The power will go off in a cafe. The cafe will just light a couple candles and keep working. I met this family recently that I asked them if they had any thought about, you know, leaving Kyiv because of the power situation, how bad it's gotten at some points. And they were like, nope, we have 100 liters of spare water on our balcony. My family is the same. You know, they are committed to staying in Odessa. That's where they were born and raised. I even, you know, early on in the war, tried to get my great aunt out of there and offered to, like, get her out of the country or move her to a safer part of the country. And she was completely resistant. I think there's a lot of pride in being Ukrainian, in, you know, living in your home. And there's a lot of pride in staying, is what I've kind of seen. My great aunt does not always have power. She lives in a high rise. So, you know, if the power goes out, it's a difficult thing for her at her age, 82, to, you know, walk up and down like 9 flights of stairs. But I think, you know, people just kind of find a way to get used to it. It's amazing what I have seen people here adapt to. And ultimately, what I constantly hear from both, you know, my Baba Zina and others is it's better this way than with Russia.
Mm. And finally, Isabel, I wonder how covering this war, you know, since early in 2022 has changed you. Surely this has been a unique experience for you as a journalist in Ukraine with your family connections.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, special because of my family. My parents, they were very young when they immigrated. They actually finished high school in the United States. And because we as a family always spoke Russian at home, I actually, you know, whenever I would be asked, like, oh, where's your family from? You know, I would just say, oh, we're Russian. But that's not true. We're not Russian. But I think that was just kind of the Soviet mentality. And that's sort of what's at stake in this war today, this identity of, no, we're not Russian, we're Ukrainian. And I think I appreciate that more being here through all of this. But just in general, I think for any reporter who's been here, it's a really intense experience because you end up seeing both the worst of humanity, kind of the awfulness of kind of death and killing and sometimes brutal torture for really no reason whatsoever. But you also see the best of humanity, how people are able to support one another, love one another, withstand so many things and kind of rise to do things even they didn't realize they were capable of. So it's been an interesting year in that sense, kind of trying to figure out what I know about humans and reconcile it all with what I've seen here. And, you know, I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. I think we have at least another year of this probably. Hmm.
Isabel Kershudian, look for her byline in the Washington Post. She is Ukraine bureau chief. Isabel, thanks so much for your work, and stay safe. Happy New Year.
Yeah, thank you. Happy New Year to you as well.